Welcome, everyone. This is a joint Ontolog mini-series session on rule standards. Today is January 9th, 2014. My co-chairs are Mike Dean and Adrian Pasch. Please, let's go to slide 2. Today's session joins the mini-series on ontology, rules, and logic programming for reasoning and applications with the mini-series of the ontology-based standards joint initiative. Slide 3. This gives our rules reasoning LP perspective on today's session, where we will talk about rule standards, common logic, RuleML, and RIF. Slide 4. Today's agenda. The focus will be on rule standards, and today's panelists are Michael Gruninger, talking about Common Logic 2nd edition. Adrian Paschke, about the RuleML perspective on deliberation reaction standards. And Michael Kiefer, about the rule interchange format and its dialects. This will be followed by a Q&A and open discussion. So, Michael Gruninger, are you ready?
Yes, I am.
Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Harold, for inviting me to present today the work on that's ongoing for the second edition of Common Logic, ISO 24707. I will be presenting, actually, I'm going to be presenting the work that Tara Athan and Fabian Neuhaus have been primarily doing. They have been leading up a lot of the revision of the semantics for Common Logic, and I'm merely presenting a lot of the work, the hard work that they've done. So if you go to slide 2, just as a bit of a refresher, the Common Logic was published in 2007 as an ISO standard, a framework for a family of logic-based languages. Essentially, Common Logic is a language based on first-order logic, but extending it in several ways that help the support its applications in the design of complex ontologies in first-order logic, as well as interoperability among knowledge-based systems. It has its roots in the knowledge interchange format and conceptual graph work in the early 90s and has kind of developed in this way. It extends common logic in a couple of ways. One is there's a notion of sequence variables, as Kiff called it, or sequence markers, which pulls common logic into a bit of an infinitary logic. I won't be talking about that today. The other kind of aspect of common logic that it's noted for is what's affectionately known as the Wild West syntax of common logic. So that within the syntax, the same symbol can appear in the relation position or as an argument position. So effectively in the syntax, it looks like you are quantifying over relations, but it still maintains first order expressiveness. If we move to slide 3, just a brief kind of, again, reminder here on the semantics of common logic. Within common logic, an interpretation consists of primarily two sets. One is the universe of reference, UR, and the other, the universe of discourse, UD, where the universe of discourse is not empty, and it's a subset of the universe of reference. So, and there's a kind of interpretation mapping that maps the vocabulary into the universe of reference. So essentially the universe of reference is the set of all the different symbols, that are in the interpretation, all set of symbols that are in the text that you're considering. And then, the universe of discourse is what you are able to quantify over. And so, the universe of discourse being a subset of that, it's a proper subset of that, then there will be some symbols which will not denote any object that's being quantified over. And so this is where we get into the interpretation of the Wild West syntax. In addition, there are a couple other, there has been a historical distinction between different dialects of common logic. So common logic was meant to be a family of logic-based languages, and so different languages within the standard are called dialects. And so in a segregated dialect, this would be the the good old-fashioned first-order logic that people refer to, where the universe of discourse is your familiar set, you know, universe in the first-order model, and you're not allowed to quantify over relations, whereas an unsegregated dialect is one where the universe of discourse is equal to the universe of reference. So if you move to slide four, again, there have been previous talks on common logic. You can kind of access those through all the different pointers within the Ontolog wiki pages, either within the ontology-based standards or other areas within Ontolog. What I want to focus on today is some of the work that has led to the development of this second edition. So really the second edition, because within ISO, every so many years, a standard comes up for review. And so there are a number of things that were identified in different applications of common logic that led to where we are today. And so on slide four, for the next few slides, actually, I'm going to be looking at presenting different ways that common logic has been used over the past 6 years and how those applications identified some problems within the original specification of common logic, and then briefly kind of outline the current proposal for addressing those problems. So on slide four, one of the applications of common logic has been in open ontology repositories. And so this is actually the OOR.net domain is the home for several of these projects within the Open Ontology Repository Initiative. Calore is the Common Logic Ontology Repository. And so there's the OR.net, which is alias to a Google code site. But because we have over 1,300 common logic ontologies in there right now, organized in different sets we call hierarchies, it actually is too long for Google code to actually display everything. And so the next URL, the Semantic Technologies Lab here in Toronto, provides a complete listing. You click on those links, that takes you to the Google code page that has all the different ontologies there. And so Calore is, again, this set about 1,300 different ontologies written in common logic, and it's supporting a lot of work that we're doing on ontology evaluation, verification, and ontology mapping. More recently, another project within the Open Ontology Repository Initiative is called OntoHub. And again, there's a URL there for the main page. It is a GitHub project. And OntoHub is a repository that is not restricted to common logic. It has a lot of OWL ontologies as well. I think it has also has a copy of many of the Calore ontologies. And it's being used as a test bed within the OntoIOP project, which I'll mention briefly in the next slide. So if you go to slide five, so slide four, we talked about the different repositories. And so this is being, you know, so we have different ontologies that are being designed, and they are particular ontology can import other ontologies. There's going to be a couple of other examples we'll see later on where having to build a complex ontology in common logic within the repository led to identification of certain problems. On slide five, we see some other ways in which common logic has been used, particularly in the design and evaluation of other ontology-based standards. So today's session is kind of a joint session between those two ideas. One has been the process specification language, which is another ISO standard, which is written in common logic. The date-time vocabulary out of OMG, which has a common logic axiomatization, among others. Then also within OMG, there's the work on foundational UML by Conrad Bach. Way back in W3C, back by 2005, actually with Michael Kiefer was involved in this project as well, was the Semantic Web Services framework, where common logic axiomatization was kind of provided for ontology there. And then finally, onto IOP, ontology interoperability. Ooh, sorry, I should have changed that slide. That's no longer an ISO project. It's officially an OMG project. I'll send an updated list of slides there. Sorry about that. And so within onto IOP, there's a need to be able to represent in a meta language the different kinds of relationships between different ontologies expressed potentially in different languages. On slide six, there's been also some, more recently, some software support for Common Logic. So out of the University of Bremen is HETS, the heterogeneous toolset, which provides support for translating between Common Logic syntaxes and other logics. The Samian platform from Kojiware Corporation has implemented several parsers and has discussed ways of providing more support for the Calore repository. Some of this work is feeding its way into a GitHub project called McLeod. McLeod is a recursive acronym standing for McLeod, a Common Logic environment for ontology design. There's the work on ontology portal, Sumo, that Adam Pease has, since it's written in a particular variant of KIF and is equivalent to a certain dialect of Common Logic. And finally, the Recon project, formerly at NIST, which is looking at rules and translations between rules, languages, and Common Logic, related also to SPDR. So if we go to slide seven, so all of these different projects I've kind of shown in the previous three slides has led to the identification of a set of issues that existed within the original spec of Common Logic. So on slide seven are some of the syntactic issues that popped up. There were different, because people were implementing parsers, there were various syntactic errors that were identified in what was called a defect report. Problems were identified with the XML syntax. So Common Logic has an abstract syntax and then has kind of an official set of three different surface syntaxes. CLIF, the Common Logic Interchange Format, CGIF, the Conceptual Graph Interchange Format, and XDL, the XML syntax. And so there were several the syntactic errors is identified in the surface syntaxes for CLIF and also for the XML syntax. And also there's just a recognition that there needs to be a more general approach to the annotation of Common Logic texts. So more than just having a comment construct, but having the ability to have more detailed kinds of annotation for an ontology that's written in Common Logic. More substantial in slide eight are some semantic issues that arose out of these applications. And so just, I'll go into detail on each of these. So briefly, there is, it was discovered that there was a problem with what are called definitional extensions in Common Logic. There were problems with how to resolve circular imports. There were problems identified with the semantics of CL module, the ability to have domain restrictions when you do imports. There are questions about how the segregated dialects, right, so I meant like good old-fashioned logic being a segregated dialect, how that could be interoperable with the unsegregated dialect, so with the full semantics of the Wild West syntax. Problems with then, given this, these interactions, some clarification of what would it mean for a particular logical language to conform to Common Logic, and then some issues with namespacing. So if you go to slide nine, so a definitional extension, I'll just kind of talk about that for a couple of slides. So a definitional extension of a logical theory is the extension of a particular theory with a set of sentences which are conservative definitions in T, in that theory. And so it's a special kind of conservative extension, again, essentially where you're providing, what you're doing is adding new terms that have an if and only if definition. And the URL that's on this slide shows how within Calore we use these definitional extensions to specify the mappings between ontologies. And so it's very crucial to be able to interpret these kinds of translation definitions, we call them, as conservative definitions and hence a definitional extension. However, on slide 10, Tilemas Sikorski first identified this, that actually definitional extensions are not conservative in Common Logic. Because, for example, if I have a particular CLIF theory T and I add a sentence for all X, if and only if PX, some formula phi, so phi is just going to stand for something else, that actually leads to new theorems in the language of T. So now we know there exists a particular particular P that satisfies that sentence. And that's something that was not entailed in the original theory. And so, again, these definitional extensions are no longer conservative, and hence they're not really definitional extensions. So this is kind of a big problem when we are trying to do these mappings within Scholari, for example, because you need to do the, we do these mappings in order to do ontology verification. On slide 11, is a little discussion here about the semantics of CL module. So in the original standard specification, CL module was intended to allow for the specification of domain restrictions. So there's an example there at a Clore where it's a particular kind of geometry, and when you import one of the other ontologies, you want to relativize all the quantifiers in that particular ontology to be in the set of points. Another example here is where we have a particular CL theory here, and we want to say, you know, for every X, there exists a Y that's less than it. But if you have a domain restriction to the positive integers, then there is not a number that is less than one. So that additional sentence there is then has a quantifier restriction to saying if X is a positive integer, then it does not there's not another element that is less than one. So even though in the entire CL text it doesn't have that domain restriction. Now in slide 12. Actually, this some problems with CL module were first identified by Fabian Neuhaus and Pat Hayes, and they have a paper in an issue of Applied Ontology a couple of years ago on resolving that problem. But it didn't quite solve a lot of the problems. And one of the things that Tara and Fabian identified were specifically problems with functions and domain restrictions. So you have this sentence, CL module person. There does not exist an X who is the spouse of Bill. So in other words, the intent here being that sentence, the quantifiers are relativized to person. It turns out because of the semantics of common logic, right? So because, Bill and spouse are in the universe of reference, and if we have a totally unsegregated dialect, spouse is not only a relation, but can also be a function. And because as a function, spouse is required to be total on the domain of person, then that common logic sense theory actually entails that the spouse of Bill is a person, even though the original sentence says that there does not exist anyone that is the spouse of Bill. And so the problem here is the way that modules, this domain restriction for modules, interacts with the requirement in a classical logic for functions to be total. On slide 13, there's another kind of example here of, again, problems with domain restrictions. And again, it kind of, you can trace it to the requirement that functions are total. So we have here that minus one is a real number. I is the square root of minus one, and, but I is not real, and you have the domain real, right? So now you have real cannot really be in domain here because square root is not total on it. If we move to slide 14, we have the problems that came up with segregated and unsegregated dialects. So in this particular example here, the CL text labeled ontology 101 has a sentence that says, P is basically a transitive relation. But it's a segregated dialect. This is good old-fashioned first-order logic, and the intent here is you're not quantifying over everything. So P is a relation, it's in the universe of reference, but it's not in the universe of discourse. On the other hand, CL text 02 is an unsegregated dialect here, because now we have, we're quantifying over all relations here. We have for all X and Y, X is reflexive if and only if X, Y, Y. And in particular, we can import 01 and say P is also reflexive. So in addition to being transitive, that's also reflexive. And so the problem here is that in the original spec, importation of common logic was restricted to text in the same dialect. On slide 15, there's the problem of circular imports. I don't quite have enough time to kind of go into we have a better example of problems of circular imports, but essentially the original specification of common logic has had difficulty resolving circular kinds of imports. And I actually include here an example. This is from one of the original Ontolingua papers back in the 90s that kind of first brought up the problem of circular imports with ontologies. And so it turns out in the original spec of common logic, it doesn't have an adequate treatment to deal with circular imports. On slide 16, there's another problem dealing with namespacing. So, I mean, this is handled in various ways by the web languages like OWL and RDF and Swirl. But within Common Logic, it's still this needs to be resolved a bit. The first edition of the standard didn't quite address it. And so, just as an example here, there's two different ontologies in Colore. One dealing with between as a geometric sort of relation, so between as a point and a line. Whereas there's another ontology called in combined time, comes from Pat Hayes' catalog temporal theories, where between is a function that maps two time points to an interval. And so you need to be able to disambiguate here between is being referred to. So on slide 17, you know, what's the current status here? So we have a current document out, kind of a working draft with ISO that contains the most recent version of the abstract syntax and proposed common semantics for common logic. This proposed semantics addresses all of the problems that I have raised in the previous few slides. There's a potential competitor to this proposed semantics, and the group is still debating over which approach to take. But this, the one I'm going to be just briefly going over the next three slides, addresses all the problems that we've identified. So on slide 18, we see a part of the proposed revision to both the abstract syntax and semantics. So first of all, in order to deal with the kind of the integration of segregated and unsegregated dialects, we explicitly introduce discourse statements as a new syntactic category. So you can actually explicitly say that the following elements of the vocabulary are in the discourse, right, in the universe of discourse, or they are out of the universe of discourse. Of course, they're all in the universe of reference, but what this allows us to do is to explicitly state the elements which are denoted by the names in the vocabulary, which of those are in the universe of discourse and which ones are not. Secondly, there's a better semantics, a better approach to domain restriction. So we have a domain operator here. It replaces the module from the original version as a syntactic category, and we use this then to restrict the domain of discourse to some particular domain, and it resolves the problems that I was showing in the earlier slides. And then finally, there's an extension of what's called a title mapping. So an interpretation also contains a title mapping from the vocabulary of a particular language to the set of text of that language. And there's this notion of a TTL, text titling operator, that replaces text as the basic syntactic category used to associate text with their titles. So on slide 19, with this revision to the semantics, definitional extensions are now allowed to exist because we can restrict which names are out of the universe of discourse. Domain restrictions now enable integration of ontologies, even if they don't all share the same universe of discourse. So that's kind of like the fundamental problem with the segregated versus unsegregated dialects. And finally, circular imports are allowed syntactically, and they are well-defined semantically. So in the original semantics, did not really, could not assign a truth value in all cases of circular imports. So the last slide, on slide 12, there's some remaining work. Given that once we adopt and accept that this is the new semantics and the new abstract syntax, the concrete syntaxes for CLIF and TGIF and XDL will need to be updated to reflect the new abstract syntax. And so far, right now, the issue of namespacing and a more general approach to annotation of texts, so some people are discussing numerical quantifiers, these have not really been addressed in the current working draft, and so that's something that still is outstanding. And so just in conclusion, we have our next working group meeting on Tuesday, January 14th at 12 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. You can join through the same joint conference bridge number, and we'll be discussing, you know, again, kind of final adoption of the newly proposed semantics. So thank you very much, and I also like to say thank you very much to Tara and Fabian for a lot of the hard work and for writing comments on earlier drafts of this talk. Thank you.
Thanks much, Michael. We will have the discussion at the end. Adrian, are you ready?
Okay. So my talk will be about WoolML, and since we already had a presentation about WoolML by Howard Bowley back in October, where the focus was more mainly on the technical aspects of WoolML and deliberation WoolML, in this talk I will focus on reaction WoolML, or many of the examples are from reaction WoolML. So on slide 2, there's the agenda. I first will introduce reaction WoolML, and then will explain several extension mechanisms of reaction WoolML, how to integrate external semantics, and how to syntactically configure different dialects within WoolML or in special examples of reaction WoolML. So slide 3 shows the general WoolML family, which basically distinguishes into two language families, namely deliberation rules and reaction rules. And then you have different sub-dialects. For example, in deliberation WoolML, you have the whole family of logic programming approaches, with different expressiveness, Horn logic, with negation, with different types of negation, disjunction, and so on, and data lock, and so on. And in the reaction WoolML family, we have different dialects which address different types of reactive rules, like production rules, event condition action rules, formalisms which are dealing with the effects of events and actions, it's KR, and so on. So slide 3 gives an overview of the main reaction WoolML dialects, starting from extensions of derivation WoolML, which deal with temporal reasoning, spatial reasoning. So there you have syntactic elements which allow you to represent time and spatial information as well as time intervals and so on. Then a dialect family called KR WoolML for knowledge representation WoolML, where you can model the effects of events in terms of different logical calculi, event calculus, situation calculus. So syntactic elements here are dealing with the description of fluents, situations, events and actions, how they initiate and terminate fluents, and so on. Then a dialect for production rules, so if condition, then action rules, which means from the syntactic perspective you have elements in the action part, so in the do part, like assert, retract, modify, which is update element action. Then dialect family for describing event condition action rules, so where the event part is explicit, and dialect which deals with definitions of complex event processing, so in particular algebra operators for defining complex events, and also distributed reactive processing, where you can have statements which allow you to send and receive messages. So slide 4 shows the general syntax of rules in WoolML, which also addresses then reaction rules. So we have a general element rule. Then we have certain meta information, which allows to define information about the rule, meta, so descriptive metadata about the rule and lifecycle management of the rule, including also scoped reasoning, so that you can define that the rules only apply to a particular scope. Then there is a distinction between an interface description of the rule and the actual implementation of the rule. In the interface description, you can define the intended semantics which should be applied for the rule and the signature definitions of the rules. And then in the implementation, you have the actual representation of the rule, in particular the different parts which you need for describing different types of reaction rules, like event part, condition part, which is an if, logical conclusion part, then action part, which is below the do element. Post-condition are possible after the actions, for example, for safeguarding the actions with syntactic constraints, and then also alternative styles of rules, which to some extent are syntactic sugar. So if you go to slide 5, you see some examples how this general syntax then can be tailored towards particular rule types by selecting certain of these sub-elements. So if you want to have a standard derivation rule, The selection is the if part for describing the conditions, and then the plan part for describing the conclusions. And additionally, there are attributes which allow us to define a particular style for this rule, which for standard derivation rules with the reasoning style. Production rules, the example here, if part, so we have the conditions, and then we have the actions which are in the do part. And the style here is active processing. Trigger rules, on, which then defines the event, and the do part, which defines an action, so a trigger rule is an EA rule, event action rule. And then the extension of this trigger mechanisms, which evolved in active databases and lead them to the event condition action paradigm, on event, if condition, do action. Then let's move on, slide 6. So now I want to explain how this syntactic descriptions can be enriched by defining semantic definitions for the evaluation or interpretation of the rules and rule bases. And on slide 7, there are three different approaches how to define or integrate semantic profiles, namely that the semantic profiles can be described directly in UML using the UML language. For the axiomatization of, for example, logical calculi, which are used in this KR dialect, like situation calculus or event calculus axiomatizations. These UML profiles, UML defined profiles, then can be directly included using XML mechanisms, XI include, so that they become part of the XML document which specifies the rule base. And then in the evaluation, you can, by using a certain profile tag, reference this defined profile by a key ref mechanism. The second variant is that a particular predefined profile is referenced as a profile type, and this is particular a mechanism which can reference existing published profiles published on the web, for example, like if UML is used as a sorted logic and includes some types, then it can reference, for example, an RDF entailment regime or an OWL entailment regime and so on, like it's specified by RIF, for example. And then the third option is to directly specify the evaluation profile, so the semantic profile, in the local UML document, in the local UML rule base. And there are two ways. One is that directly the UML syntax is used. Then, of course, the XML parsers would directly understand the syntax, but there's also a general element called content, which allows to embed arbitrary XML content definition, or to embed, for example, profiles which are defined in Common Logic or profiles which are defined in RIF or other XML-based languages. Slide 8 gives some examples, or I will give several examples now. Slide 8 gives examples of what kinds of parameters are important in semantic profiles for complex event processing. So in complex event processing, operational semantics are quite important for the definition of particular event patterns in terms of algebra operators. Then for the selection and consumption policies, they have a huge impact on what kind of events, complex events, are detected. So if we have an event instance sequence, if we select, for example, only the first event in this sequence, or if we also select the last events, or if we have additional functions like rating or scoring functions, which then lead to more sophisticated selection policies. And similar consumption policies. So here we can define, for example, if events contribute to the detection of only one complex event and then they are consumed, or if they can contribute to multiple complex event detections, and similar for the execution. So execution policies in particular also can be important for complex actions. If these complex actions are, for example, only are hypothetical effects, or if they have a real effect on the knowledge base leading to some updates, and then include, for example, transactional logic so that these updates can be rolled back in case, for example, the post conditions are violated in ECA rules which are extended with post conditions. slide 9 now gives an example how these profiles can be referenced from the actual implementation. So if we have such a rule which defines an interface and an implementation, then in the interface, this evaluation tag, which embeds the different profiles, in these profiles we can define the selection and consumption policies. Additionally, in the interface we can define the signatures, which for reaction rules, for event condition action rules, would be the event pattern definition of the event which we want to detect. So the signature here defines what kind of events trigger a particular rule. And this whole interface is or can be referenced then in the implementation part. In this example, we have an event condition action rule on event if conditions do actions. And in the on part where we want to detect the events, we reference the event pattern definition which has been defined in the interface. So they can be even published in a distributed way that, for example, only publish the interface, and then the implementation is locally represented in a particular system. Another example, slide 10, for logic programming semantic profiles. So here are some examples of typical logic programming semantics and a kind of classification of these semantic profiles, where which extend the lower level profiles, and depending on which kind of expressiveness class we have as a logic program, we can choose different semantics. So slide 11 gives an example of how these profiles can be used. So again, we have this distinction between interface and implementation. In the interface definition, here we have specified two evaluation profiles, namely first profile is well-founded semantics and the second profile is answer set semantics. The attribute index here imposes some ordering on the semantics, so the preferred intended semantics is well-founded semantics, and then the second choice is answer set semantics here. And then this interface, which defines the signature of the rule and also the profiles which can be applied to it, is referenced in the implementation, which then implements the actual rule. Slide 12. In addition to this explicitly definition of semantic profiles, we can also use test cases for validating rule bases when they are interchanged between different inference engines. So the idea of these test cases is basically that they approximate the intended models of the rule base as much as possible. So we need to define as much as possible test cases so that all these test cases together give an approximation of the particular models. What we need for that is we need to predefine the outcome of these test cases. That's done by positive or negative label and additionally variable bindings. Test queries, which are the test cases itself or the tests on the knowledge bases. And then additionally, we can specify assertion bases, which can be just facts if we only want to test the rules. But it can be also complete rule programs that's used, for example, then to test certain semantic properties where we, in the test case, interchange a complete rule base, predefine the results from the rule base, and then can test whether the inference engine actually fulfills a particular semantic property, like Cauchy's monotony, for example. So that was a quick overview on how semantic profiles can be used to define the intended semantic for rule bases and rules. Another extension mechanism is semantic metamodels, which are defined in RuleML and the use of external ontologies. RuleML, that's now slide 14. RuleML provides an extension for sorted logic, which syntactically are described by an attribute at type. With this at type attribute, we can point to external vocabularies or ontologies, which then define these particular types. So there are two examples. Variable car, for example, can be typed here in this example, with a concept vehicle defined in some vehicle ontology. Also for individuals, we can do this. So the second example here shows a particular webized resource individual called Corolla, and that's of type Sedan. So in principle, this type approach allows to extend the syntax of RuleML and define the types of the syntactic elements of RuleML. And that's used, that's slide 15 now. That is used to define general extension points in the syntax, which then can get typed and then have a particular meaning. Like, for example, there's a general syntactic element called quantifier. And then by using the type attribute, we can point to predefined quantifiers. Some of them can be predefined in the meta models, typical one for all exist. But you can also define new quantifiers in additional ontologies, specific quantifiers as they are used, for example, in complex event processing, regex rules. Similar operators can be overloaded by pointing to this external definition end, for example, which then corresponds to a particular RuleML end, or negations, different types of negations. So negation element or the tag negation is also a generic extension point, and then you can point to specific types of negation. In this example, inflationary negation, which is typical negation in many of the production rule systems. Similar for typical elements which are useful in regex rules, like actions, so a general element action, which then can be specialized with predefined concepts from the regex rule and meta model as a retract, or also point to external definitions. So the example is this event type, which then points to the IBM Common Base description of events. Or, for example, operator as an example, which then points to the Snoop algebra operators. In this example, it would be a Snoop sequence operator, which corresponds to the sequence elements within RegRuleML. Another extension mechanism is the IRI attribute. In this IRI attribute, we can point to concrete resources and can also embed X pointer syntax here to select certain subsets of XML documents. Then slide 16 shows the general approach of this meta model definitions in RegRuleML for the syntactic definitions for the general operators. And basically what RuleML is doing here is it only defines a top level layer of ontological concepts, which then can be enriched with existing ontological definitions for certain domain concepts, task concepts, and so on. So basically what RuleML only defines are very generic concepts, action concepts, event concepts, where we distinguish basically between atomic events and complex events, situations, processes, and so on. And slide 17 now. In the meta model definition, it's then possible to define as a kind of meta modeling approach what kind of properties and values for these properties the particular event classes should have, and then these event classes can be used as types which then can be specialized by existing ontologies. So basically the idea is not to reinvent everything, but just to provide a kind of conceptual definition extension point which allows us to define types so that they can be more specialized by existing ontologies. Or meta-modeling approach here. Slide 18 shows then the full meta-model, where you, in addition to just defining the properties, also can define certain computational properties and complex value definitions, which are important for complex event processing, like computational algorithm, collecting algorithms, possible values for certain event values, and so on. And then slide 19 shows how this top-level concepts in the meta model can be used to define the types for the syntactic definitions. So in this example, we define a complex event at the beginning with the key CE2. This complex event is defined as a sequence, so a sequence definition of embedded events. In the sequence, we then have a simple event definition, and then we have another embedded complex event called CE1, or referencing the definition of this complex event called CE1, and a third event in the sequence which references an external ontology definition, namely the ConBase event vocabulary. And in this embedded complex event, CE1, that references then a distributed definition of the event. So this complex event is an embedded concurrent definition of two events. And this nested embedding of several simple events or complex events into the complex event CE2 then can become instantiated by a concrete event instance. That's at the bottom of this example, where the event with the key E1, so a concrete event instance, references this pattern definition of the complex event. So basically, this complex event, for example, can then be used in the on part of the event condition action rule to detect the complex event, and the concrete event instance, which is created by this pattern detection, would then be this key event E1. So moving on, slide 20, besides this extension points, it's also possible to configure the syntax of RuleML on a more fine-grained level. And there's a configuration framework called MIN, which allows to configure the different RELAX and GE schema modules so that you have a fine-grained selection of different syntactic elements which are used in a particular RuleML or ReactRuleML dialect. So here are some choices basically for derivation RuleML shown in this configuration form of the MIN framework. And then by selecting these different configuration elements, you can tailor your own syntactic dialect. So certain expressiveness class, for example, of a logic program, or certain syntactic elements which you want to have in your reaction rule language for complex event processing or for ECA style processing. In particular for reaction rule and all that's ongoing work to come up with good configurations, fine-grained syntactic modularization of the syntax for reaction rule. Slide 23 now to summarize this whole talk. So what I showed is with this MIN framework that has been already presented in October, back in October, you can have fine-grained syntactic language configuration. For the syntactic configuration, you can explicitly specify the semantics which should be applied, even alternative semantics, by referencing semantic profiles, which can be either defined directly in RuleML or can be already existing profiles which are just referenced. Test cases can be used for additional validation as a kind of approximation of the intended semantics. So like in most test-driven development, it's the 80-20 rule, so if 80% of the test cases succeed, then that's often sufficient quality. And then particular expressiveness extension in RuleML is that the type attribute allows to reference external type definitions, leading then to a sorted logic. And here, either types which are defined in the meta model of RuleML can be referenced, or types which are defined in external semantic ontologies. Okay, that's it.
Thank you, Adrian. Michael Kiefer, are you ready?
Thank you. So let's go to slide number two. So I'm going to talk about the rule interchange format and the dialect of the rule interchange format. This is going to be an overview. Specifically, I'm going to talk about the logic-based, mostly about the logic-based dialect of the rule interchange format, because it is divided into two categories. One is for the production rules, and the other one is for logic-based rules. So let's go to slide number three. So what is the rule interchange format? So basically, it's a collection of dialects for exchanging and sharing rules over the web. And it's also a framework that provides for the certain consistency among these dialects. So, for example, they all share the same XML syntax, the presentation syntax, and also there is a framework for sharing the semantic elements. Let's go to slide number three. So why are we talking about the rule exchange and not sort of one rule language like Common Logic? Actually, Common Logic is also not one rule language. It's essentially a collection of dialects. Problem was that just like with any logic, there are many different paradigms for rule languages. There are rules based on just your first order logic, logic programming rules, and there are many different types of logic programming rules. There are production rules, reactive rules. There are, variety of syntaxes. There are preferences, commercial products and interests. So it was perceived that it's not possible to really successfully propose one rule language that will, satisfy all needs. And so W3C decided to develop a framework exchanging among different rule systems rather than subsuming all of them. Let's go to slide number five. this framework was it was decided to build this framework around the idea of dialect, which is kind of a natural one. The problem, again, is the diversity of the different syntaxes and semantics. And so it was decided to create a number of dialects so that different systems could exchange rules by mapping their rules into those dialects in a semantically preserving way. So, of course, this implies also that different systems may not be able to exchange all their rules among themselves, but they would be able to identify subsets that could be exchangeable with other systems. Slide number six. So the current state of the RIF dialect is that basically, there's at the bottom of the picture here, there's a core dialect, which basically is a subset of all dialects in RIF. And then we developed two other dialects. One is the production rule dialect, the dialect which is on the left, and the basic logic dialect on the right. And those dialects are W3C standard. And then later on, we developed additional dialects for logic programming dialects with well-founded semantics and stable model semantics. And those are not W3C dialects, but they have been developed under the RuleML umbrella. But they use the rule interchange format machinery. The production rule dialect is kind of separate from the logical dialect because it doesn't have a logical semantics, and so we decided to let it go because in the time frame that we were given, it was not possible to integrate it properly with the other dialects. But the basic logic dialect is essentially a dialect that supports horn rules without negation in the rule bodies, and it has a much richer syntax than horn rules. In particular, it supports frame syntax like an F logic, and not just predicates. Let's go to slide number 7. Now the fact that only this basic logic dialect was developed as part of the W3C was kind of a problem, because W3C didn't want to expand the scope of the working group to allow us to develop a more useful dialect like those that are at the top of the previous slide. However, they did allow us to develop a framework that could be used to develop more advanced dialects. And this framework is interesting in its own right. It's called RIF-FLD Framework for Logical Dialects. Because this framework is interesting because it's a very general kind of quasi-logical framework that allows us to build logics out of it by specializing the various components that were left underdefined. So I'm going to briefly explain what this framework is. And by the way, those dialects at the top of the previous slide were defined using the framework for this logical dialect. So let's go to slide number 8. So this logical framework for these dialects is essentially a set of formal guidelines for constructing the dialect, and it includes the syntactic framework, the semantic framework, and the XML syntax framework. So all so the syntax, presentation syntax, and the semantics, as well as the XML syntax, can be obtained by specializing from this general framework. Let's go to slide number 9. So why did we create the framework? So first of all, one reason was that, as I said, W3C didn't let us define more general dialects that could be actually useful for the existing rule systems. And so we had to provide something that could enable sort of future extensions. But the other reason is that W3C required a very precise document, you know, as to the syntax and semantics, and it was deemed to be very hard to develop those documents from scratch. For example, you know, the basic logic dialect that defines essentially just the horn rule, it took more than 30 pages of pretty, you know, complicated text to define it precisely. And so it means that any other dialect that is more complicated than the basic logic dialect would take, you know, 40, 50 pages, and there will be no, it's a very serious commitment for many months. So what we wanted to do was to define sort of a framework that would allow us to specify this dialect in a much simpler way. So, for example, the same basic logic dialect can be specified in like 2.5 pages by specializing from this framework for RIF dialect. So in some way, you can say it's a super dialect, which includes every other dialect, but this is not completely true, because if we go to the next slide, slide number 10, it says that RIF FLD is not really a fully specified dialect, so it's not a dialect. but a framework. So what it has is it defines a very general syntax. So it allows things like frame syntax, predicate syntax. It allows for higher order syntax like high log syntax and many other things. However, there are several parameters that are not specified, and they are actually left or underspecified. There are many choices which are not always compatible with each other, and so it is left to the actual dialect that will be specialized on this syntax to define those parameters. The same thing is about the semantics. It provides a framework for choosing a particular semantics and specifying it, but there are several aspects that are left to the actual dialect to specify what they want exactly. And the same thing for the XML syntax. So the dialects can have to say, you know, what how to specialize from the general syntax. Let's go to slide number 11. As far as the syntactic framework is concerned, first of all, in general, in Reef, there are two syntaxes. There's the presentation syntax and the XML syntax. The XML syntax is very complicated, as usual with XML, and it is intended for exchanging rules through the network. And basically, it's machine readable, and it's human readable only in the sense that they can see the characters, but it's very difficult to understand what's behind the trees there. And the presentation syntax was developed so that people could read it as a logic, and it was designed to basically to exchange the specifications among humans so that they can understand what's going on. It also, all the examples are written in this presentation syntax, and in principle it could also be used for rule authoring if appropriate tools were provided. And this presentation syntax uniquely maps into the XML syntax, so there's a one-to-one correspondence. So let's go to slide 12. So the syntactic framework, as I said, was designed so that it will be general and could be specialized by the various dialects. It also was designed so that the syntax could be, will have a model phonetic semantics. So it will be mappable into the semantic framework. Next, slide 13. How does the semantic framework look like? So it basically defines the notion of semantic structures, which are intended to determine when a formula is true. And the semantic framework is also very general. It supports various different kinds of syntax. So different kinds of syntax could be interpreted in that semantics, in particular frame syntax, predicate syntax, predicates with named arguments. It also supports high-order features like high log. It supports reification of everything, you know, every kind of formula. It supports multivalued logics so that we could express uncertainty and inconsistency and so on. Slide 14. The key to the semantic framework is the notion of logical entailment. So the problem with semantics in rule languages is that, first of all, unlike common logic, our focus was on the semantics for rule languages, which is normally non-monotonic. So the monotonic semantics of first-order logic is considered to be uninteresting for rule languages. So we have to deal with different semantics that are not actually compatible with each other. We have to integrate this into one semantic framework. So this was done using the notion of logical entailment, which is defined in very general terms, and then again the dialect could specialize from that framework. So, and as I said, the different semantics could be incompatible. In general, they are, and so it's unlikely to find one notion of entailment, and therefore, when we provide a framework for that and the various mechanisms for defining the semantic structures. Let's go to slide 15. The way the framework defines the semantics is that it defines the notion of intended models which dialects have to define. So there is various machinery in the framework that allows you to define intended models by specializing from the framework in about half a page or one page, but it doesn't define what an intended model is. It just provides the machinery for defining it, and then the notion of entailment says that. For example, P implies Q if for every intended model that satisfies P, that model also satisfies Q. Okay, so once the dialects specialize the notion of intended models, then the logical entailment is defined. Let's go to slide 16. There are other things that the framework provides for, and this is essentially the concept of sorts or types. So the set of all constants can be partitioned into subsets, which could have their own semantics. There are some predefined subsets, like subset of IRIs, local constants that are basically sort of encapsulated symbols, and various data types like integers. Essentially, every XML data type is what is called a symbol space in Reef. And then there are other things that are defined, like document formulas and meta annotations, which are sort of metalogical rather than logical. Okay, so let's go to slide 17. So what are the dialects that currently exist? I already mentioned the core dialect, which is essentially a very small dialect, which is a subset that embeds itself both in horn rules and production rules. So from the logical point of view, this is not an interesting dialect, but the only interest in that dialect is that it's the smallest dialect that through which we can exchange rules, even with production rules. And then there is a basic logic dialect, which is essentially horn rules, as I said, and it supports frames and predicate syntax. It doesn't support any higher order features. The interesting thing, though, is that it supports equality. So equality can be used both in the premises and conclusions, which means that you can define, the fact that, say, two terms are equal. And then there's a number of dialects that were defined under the RuleML umbrella. So one was for the dialect with the answer set semantics or stable model semantics. The other dialect was for the well-founded semantics. And the third dialect was for the uncertainty, ruled uncertainty. Let's go to slide 18. So what's the current status of Reef? A number of tools have been defined. By the way, I forgot to mention that Reef was made a standard in acquisition in 2010. And after that, the working group had been ended its work. So there is nothing really going on in Reef under the W3C umbrella anymore. And since then, a number of tools have been defined. However, we have to admit that the uptake has been pretty slow until now. So one reason is, I think, the publicity, because the W3C, as I mentioned before, basically the way they set up the group, it made it very hard to develop something useful really for existing rule systems. And the dialects that have been defined under the RuleML umbrella have not been widely publicized. So most people are aware of the basic logic dialect, but they are, you know, less aware about the dialects based on well-founded semantics and stable model semantics. So the only thing, as I said, that we could push through in the working group was this framework for future extensions of Reef. Let's go to slide number 19. So here there is a link to the web page that lists all the implementations that were known by 2010. So in particular, I think some of the most advanced implementations are those that are in the Ontobroker system and Reef, and Silk. Unfortunately, the Silk project has been terminated, so this implementation is not available anymore. But there are several others like Reef4j and Reef-TR and so on. Let's go to slide number 12. So here I have a number of links for further reading. So there's a link to the framework, to the basic logic dialect, and to the three dialects that were developed under the RuleML umbrella. And that's the end of my talks. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Michael. So now people should bring up comments, questions, and so on. Let's use the same order in which the panelists spoke. So first, maybe discussion about Michael Gruninch's presentation.
Yeah, I tried to answer some of the ones that rose in the chat.
Could you read the questions and then give your answers?
Let's see here. So Leo had some questions about examples of the difference between universe of discourse and universe of reference, and I pointed him to slide. In particular, slide 14, that went through his example. Benjamin had an interesting question about some of how some of the issues that led to this new version of the semantics for common logic would impact some of the things that are happening within RuleLog. So that looks interesting.
I see both of them in the queue. Maybe if I want to add something to their written questions. Leo?
Good. Yes, Michael. So slide 14. So the difference between segregated and unsegregated, so segregated would be in the universe of discourse?
So in a segregated dialect, the universe of discourse is a proper subset of the universe of reference. So there's a set of terms from the vocabulary, which intuitively say would be your relations, and you do not quantify over those. So, whereas
unsegregated means that they are distinct, and but yet you could, well, I mean, could you have a segregated dialect where you quantified over relations?
Right. No. So in a segregated dialect, you would not, because that symbol could not appear in both the argument position and the predicate position. So you'd want to have an unsegregated dialect. And that's, you know, kind of the Wild West syntax. And, you know, there's that example there. And, you know, again, it's still first order because it lacks the comprehension, sort of schema that you would find within second order logic, right? So in second order logic, the semantics of second order logic say that there is a single domain in every interpretation, right, which is the power set of the domain of elements. And so there you're quantifying over all subsets of a domain. And so that's what leads to all the you know, issues with second order logic. But then common logic, you're not quantifying over all possible subsets of the universe. You're only quantifying over, loosely speaking, the relations that you can give names to. But it's a finite set.
Okay. A related question. I guess you have to stop your type theory at second order at most then?
Well, no, again, it's not second order semantics.
No, not semantically, but I mean, so can you have higher order types,
no,
though?
No,
that,
no.
No, right?
No.
Okay.
Amanda, what is your comment or question?
I have a question following up on what was just talked about. I'd like to ask Michael what about the contrast between this sort of approach to typing, where you're sort of restricting the entire domain at once, versus an approach which allows which restricts the universe of discourse for particular assertions or queries according to typing of the arguments of the predicates involved, so that you're ranging essentially only over admissible things for a particular predicate. So some quantified variables may range over predicates and others only over more restricted object types. And so I'm looking at the contrast and I'm wondering about how you view the trade-off between those things. I know it's actually a larger common logic question because you don't have that typing, but.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, so that's one of the things that the new version of the semantics is handling by this new syntactic construct, the discourse statements. So you can have in discourse and out discourse mm-hmm. Declarations. So you can explicitly say, you know, the following things are outside the universe of discourse, and the following things are. So it gives you that ability to kind of, it's not all or nothing. It can be in between. And so then, if you wanted to, if you didn't want to actually put in the sort restrictions on a particular formula, you would then use the domain restrictions to kind of restrict you the restriction of quantifiers, the relativization of quantifiers to a particular set.
Okay.
But that's exactly what the in discourse and out discourse thing allows you to do. So it kind of allows you to then have this interoperability between dialects. And actually, I'm kind of, you know, really guilty about this because within Colore, we have been using Cliff. And if you read the spec, the ISO spec, the Cliff concrete syntax is an unsegregated dialect. And so effectively, when you're reading through all the theories in Colore, then, you should be allowed to be, you know, quantifying over everything, even over all the relation names. Mm-hmm. And that sort of wasn't intended in the original approach. And so this idea of having in discourse, out of discourse, we're going to have to, once this is kind of adopted, we're going to have to go through and revisit every one of the, theories, ontologies in Colore, and kind of determine what was the original design intent.
So that's pretty much the in discourse, out discourse is a sort of per ontology or per module level.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's correct. Is that right, Tara? That's my understanding. Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Benjamin, please go ahead.
Great. Can you hear me?
Yes. Can you go closer?
Okay, good. I thought it was a very interesting review of the issues in common logic that are still open or currently open, let's put it that way, from a semantic and syntactic viewpoint. And I suspect that one or more may be, there may be similar issues in RULOG, although I suspect that probably several of them are not issues in RULOG. But one is this issue of circular import, and I was wondering, which you called inclusion, actually. So I was wondering what is the technical approach to that? I mean, I can imagine something like a horn-style least fixed point treatment of recursion, essentially, there.
Tara, maybe are you able to answer the question? Because Tara had a really good example that I didn't really have space to stick into the talk. Maybe, Tara, you could address that. Actually, Tara is uniquely positioned to answer these questions because she's kind of in she is the intersection between RULE-ML and Common Logic.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, great.
Okay. The Common Logic approach to imports, I don't know if it's like anything. We just sort of pulled it out of thin air. Which doesn't mean it's not like anything. It's just we didn't follow any template when we put it together. Basically that we take a finite set of texts which have these importations, and one of the tricky things is that the importations can occur inside domain restrictions. Even though you may say, for example, import the same text multiple places, if one is out in the outside universe and one is inside a domain restriction, they don't have the same entailments. What we did was essentially build up a recursive importation, one text at a time, and then do each of the importations that might appear in the imported text and so on, which may give you an infinite set of texts when you're done, if there is circularity. And that's okay. You just include all of the partial resolutions of those importations in your corpus and do your semantics based on that.
Okay,
so,
thanks.
Sure.
Yeah. Tara, I'll get with you sideband about that. But I had another question, which is maybe it's related. Michael, you listed this issue about extending annotation for CL texts.
Right.
Could you elaborate a bit what the issue is there?
Well, so again, right now all that you're able to do is just have basic comments. But it would be really ideal to be able to, for lack of a better metaphor, kind of marking up particular kinds of ideas to be able to say, things like provenance, where axioms, certain axioms come from, and being able to kind of embed a lot of these kind of comments within, embed these annotations, like say within a particular text in a better way, rather than just having CL comment, quotation marks, text, blah, 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 that kind of thing. That's been a little bit of a vague thing. I mean, people have been kind of asking for some better way of dealing with that, but it's that sort of idea that more than just writing a comment before and after a particular piece of common logic text, but being able to mark up pieces of text with that other kind of information.
So in RULOG, the approach that we take is to have IDs for statements.
Right,
for
exactly.
Assertions.
Yeah, things like
and,
that.
And
yeah.
So that provides tremendous power and flexibility for that, and you can have assertions about assertions or rules that talk about other rules and so on. And you can talk about groups of rules, so you can make assertions about groups of rules and so on. So I know that when I discussed that, the possibility to put that in the past, there were concerns about semantics that made a number of people in CL not want to take that approach, but maybe that should be revisited.
There's supposed to be a distinction here between the object language and if there is a meta language. And so I think earlier approaches wanted to try to treat that all as a meta language and, say, for example, KIF combined a lot of language and meta language together. So there's like a quote operator and there's an explicit meta language that was explicitly part of the language itself. And that's where people got uneasy when KIF was revisited to become common logic. That's what made a lot of people uneasy. I think when people are talking about the annotation of text, it would be something that would not be part of the object language. It would be something that would be more meta-linguistic. But there would be a clear separation between the object language and these meta-threaded constructs, which would be used strictly for annotation, as opposed to being interpretable.
Okay, all right. Well, I think that's good as far as it goes. Again, we can take that sideband.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to understand the problem that you listed also on slide 10, where you talked about the definitional extension not being conservative.
Mm-hmm.
The usual notion of a conservative extension, as I learned it for logic, would be that if you add the first statement here,
mm-hmm.
The language without phi would be extended conservatively. Not that the language with phi would be extended conservatively.
Right, so phi here is just like a placeholder for a bunch of other axioms that are already in T.
Ah, okay. I thought phi was a new symbol.
No, sorry. Yeah.
Now I
really should have made a better example there. Like it would be, theory of before from a time ontology or whatever.
Okay, so here's a question for Michael K.
Benjamin.
Is that something that would or would not be conservative in RULOG? That was my last question, or last part of this overall question about the overlap issues.
Todd, do you have a question about common logic?
Michael, maybe you can reply via the chat.
Yes, I do.
Okay. Todd, please go ahead.
Question for Michael Gruninger. Michael, what's your prognosis for commercial support for common logic or some dialect thereof, in particular reasoners? When can I start using this or promoting it to customers or clients as a viable and risk or minimal less risk alternative?
Well, I don't really know of too many even classical first order reasoners that are kind of at that commercial level. The ones that are kind of widely used are often kind of open source ones, or at least ones that are freely available.
In comparison to where the state of OWL is today, there's several companies around the world that provide some sort of reasonable products that can do something.
Yeah, I would say that in that sense, Common Logic is where the Protégé team was 10 years ago.
Oops.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
There are people that have been thinking about implementing native reasoners in Common Logic. A lot of the work that we've been doing in particular has kind of relied on translation into the syntax of, say, classical first-order logic prover. So, in our lab, we use prover 9. The HETS team has a whole bunch of reasoners, and they translate common logic into one of their syntaxes, like from the TPTP repository, for example. And so that's kind of been the mode that people have been using. All the common logic applications within industry have been of that form. Now, there have been a few people that have discussed the idea of implementing fully native common logic reasoner, but I think there's been kind of a dearth of funds. I don't know. Maybe we could crowdsource it.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Michael, do you think that OntoIOP will change the situation?
Well, OntoIOP is primarily a meta language, not an ontology or not representational language per se. So OntoIOP is really meant to do a lot of the language mappings. So, you know, that the idea is you could map between CommonLogic and OWL and things like that, or for mappings between ontologies. So and the ability to build ontologies that are actually specified in different representation languages. So I don't see it. It doesn't compete with common logic in that sense. It's kind of fulfilling a different role.
Right. I meant it could even support common logic by building tools in and out of common logic.
Right. Well, that's what Hetz has been effectively doing.
Right. Okay. Are there other questions about common logic? Adrian needed to leave, so maybe ask questions to him on different channels. So let's move on now to questions to Michael Kay. Benjamin had already started side conversation with Michael Kiefer. So I say a question. So I see Benjamin. Yes, please go ahead.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Hey, Michael, can you hear me? Michael, I had a question about how the example on Michael Gruninger's slide 10 would behave in HiLog or RuLog.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Can you?
Yes.
Okay. So if we are talking about just plain HiLog, then the example on slide 10 will be the same in HiLog because, as you know, the original common logic was just a reinvention of HiLog 10 years later. So it's only later that all the scaffolding that was added to HiLog and common logic, they diverged. And this is essentially a basic common logic and basic HiLog. But if we are talking about the omni-transform, so if we are talking about the rule log, which probably will include, it hasn't been finalized, but it will also include probably the omni-transform, then the semantics is going to be different, right? So in that case, I need to think whether it's still going to be. I think it's going to be a conservative extension in rule log.
Okay, so I guess in HiLog, you know, part of this question is this actually an undesirable behavior? I mean, Michael G was basically saying, ooh, this is a problem for HiLog. Okay, leave RuLog aside.
Right.
What's your view on that? I mean, is this a bad thing to have happen, this existential conclusion?
I don't see why actually it should be a conservative extension and why it is bad, but it depends on the uses of, you know, on the intended uses. HiLog was intended for logic programming, right? So it was never intended to be used in this way. It was just defined in a very general way so that it will be, you know, ended up to be as general as it is. But the intent was always to use it for logic programming, where this would not be a problem.
Right, it's a problem.
Common logic is, yeah.
Yeah, it's a problem with these applications for ontology mappings in particular, because you want to be able to say that, you know, if you want to say two ontologies are equivalent, then the translation definitions that are essentially defining the terms of one ontology using sentences of the other, if they're not conservative, then what you're effectively doing is you're kind of sneaking in or importing additional expressions that are not entailed by the other ontology, not even entailed by either ontology, but are actually being entailed by your mappings themselves. And so you want these mappings to be conservative definitions so that you're guaranteeing that, again, nothing else is being snuck in. And you can truly say that two ontologies are equivalent or that one ontology is stronger than another and exactly how it could be extended to become equivalent.
Right, but this is this type of sentences are not suitable for mappings anyway, right? So in the HiLog paper, there was actually a theorem that essentially was stating when this kind of conditions will not arise. And then there was a later paper, maybe 10 years ago, by Jos de Bruijn and others, where they generalized this theorem to a more general statement. So, but this for all kind of statements, they of the kind that you have, I don't think they, I don't think they, they're typical of ontology mapping.
Oh, no, but they are quite the opposite. There are a lot of, I say the previous slide shows all the examples within Calore. So, for example, in slide 10, that particular sentence, so when Benjamin is referring to the phi, see, this would be an example of a mapping. So if P is a relation name in ontology 2, and you were defining, what this is doing is defining it. So phi is from ontology T, and so you're effectively providing a definition of one ontology's relation P using sentences from the other ontology T. And so this is exactly what ontology mapping in full-first order logic does.
The question is whether this P is should be quantifiable, right?
Phi is not P. No, that's just exactly the problem, though, because
I think about the P. Because
no, PHI phi is not quantifiable here. Phi is just a placeholder for an entire formula.
I'm talking about the P. I'm talking about the predicate that actually causes this problem. So if it's quantifiable, then yes. But the question is whether this is a reasonable assumption to quantification over P.
Well, no, but that's precisely the thing, though, is that in an unsegregated dialect, you can quantify every name denotes an object and a relation and a function. So every name is in the universe of discourse. And so by that sentence alone, P is in the universe of discourse in an unsegregated dialect.
What I mean is that in Hilog there are sorts, so there could be a sort of predicates that are quantifiable and sort of predicates that are not quantifiable. So the question is that whether the predicates that are used in the mapping should be quantifiable.
Exactly, and that's what led to the in-discourse and out-discourse statements in the new version of the...
As I said, that the scaffolding that was added to common logic and Hilog over the years, they are different. But I guess they are intended to deal with the same kind of a problem. So in Hilog there are sorts where you can define a sort of predicates that are not quantifiable. So then in that dialect, this will not be a problem.
Fox, did you see Tara's question in the chat? She writes, in Hilog, don't you have to explicitly state that the new relation is a Hilog relation?
No. It depends. In Hilog with sorts, you have to give a sort, right? And then for each sort, you have to say what's allowed. But in the original Hilog, it's like the original common logic. There is no distinction. Everything is allowed.
Michael, did you discover other questions written in the chat which you could possibly
use?
Yes.
There was a question by Leo.
Harold, before we go on to other questions, could I just make a comment here?
Of course.
So I do think that, you know, in terms of the upshot from that discussion between Michael, the two Michaels, which was very interesting, I think it's really worth seriously considering whether one wants these mappings to be conservative with respect to one of the two ontologies that you're mapping between. From my viewpoint, I don't think that's a reasonable requirement as a general requirement, because when you specify the mappings, you're specifying additional information. So essentially in the KB or the context that includes the additional mapping information, yes, there is additional non-conservative things said about those starting ontologies.
Right, and you can actually say that a mapping is it ties together two different theories, and so because the theories originally intended to be separate, it's not clear whether it's necessary to, to consider the bonding of the two Cs to be somehow conservative.
I couldn't disagree more strongly with that position. So, you know, if you look up work with doing mappings between ontologies, the mappings have to be neutral. Otherwise, you're importing additional statements for doing the mappings. So if you look up it's not just ontology mapping. Just look up the notion of interpretability between theories from Enderton, Peirce, Van Bentham, and Visser. They all kind of take that same approach.
Yeah, what I mean is that these theorems that you are adding, they are not theorems in the original ontologies that are being mapped to each other, right? So,
well, no, that's
what I mean.
The thing is that the one sentence is being expressed in the kind of the mixed vocabulary. So you don't want to be able to entail any new kinds of expressions in the other ontology, which is what you'd be allowing
to
do.
I guess, Michael, I don't know if I would say I couldn't disagree more strongly, but I would say I disagree. I would say that you have a new knowledge base that does not have to be conservative with respect to what the old knowledge base was. So with all due respect to previous human generations of classical logicians, we understand much better what the potential applications of such knowledge bases, and hence whether the requirement of conservativeness or not should be imposed than they did, because we just have a much expanded universe of applications for this stuff than they did.
Well, but I'm saying this arose from the ontology verification that we've been doing within Calore. So all those theories, the time ontologies, process ontologies, mirror topology, Dolce, upper ontologies like that, all are using this approach and all depend on that approach.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just, this is not just an academic exercise.
My point is that I think, one way to reconcile this is to say that we want to be able to control conservativeness. So to be able to achieve conservativeness when that's desired. But I just was saying I wouldn't expect to be conservative unconditionally or, you know, in all circumstances. I think what you're saying is perfectly consistent with what I was saying, the last bit of what you said. That sometimes you want to require conservativeness.
Okay, well, we'll continue.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Mike.
Amanda, do you have a remark?
I do. I think actually this is a really important point. And so I'm contrasting. Michael, you know, you made the statement that sort of that the mapping statements have to be neutral, and neutral between the ontologies that you're mapping between, assuming you're doing that from some independent perspective, yes, but there's also an enormous realm of application in which your sort of your home viewpoint that you're doing inference in is not either of those original ones, or is one of them, and you're not take an example of the psych micro theories, which I think you're familiar with to some extent. You know, it's very common to have things extended in a lower micro theory than they were initially defined, and in that case, since the inheritance between micro theories, which are essentially modules or you know theories in lots in the general sense, that inheritance doesn't flow back up. So there's no additional implications within the micro theory or the ontology that you extended,
mm-hmm.
only within anything that inherits from the extension point down. So and you can you know. You have to sort of maintain awareness of where you're doing inference, right, or querying in order to do that. So I guess I do see your point about you need to be aware of that, and you need to be careful of unfortunate, you know, non-conservative extension when it's going to have implications for or it's going to be taken to have implications for context outside of the one that you're reasoning in. But I think that Ben's point is also important, that you can sort of mark the context that you're mapping in as a specific theory itself.
Right, and this is analogous to the whole idea of modularity within ontologies, where
yeah.
a module is a sub-theory of the ontology, which is conservatively extended by the ontology.
Yeah.
So you can think of these mappings as being a generalization of the notion of module from a theory which is in the same with the same signature to theories that have different signatures.
Mm-hmm.
So I got confused with Amanda's statement is in support of Benjamin and mine statement or Michael G's statement.
Both to some extent, but I think Michael's right that there's an issue about conservative extension and being aware of it and making sure that you are clear on when you are and are not doing it and be able to restrict it sometimes. But I'm also agreeing with Ben's statement that the mapping statements happen in a theory. And that
right. Okay. So
yeah.
All right.
So
because in Rulog we can restrict this
yes.
to disallow this kind of inferences, but we just don't see it as a problem.
Right. And from my experience working with in you know modularly importing OWL ontologies or in psych micro theories, it's not a problem in those contexts because it's controllable because of the mapping is explicitly being made in a you know a named and known theory that is not sending inference and additional information back to the original one that's being extended.
Thanks, Amanda.
Yeah.
Michael K., you wanted to come back to Leo's remark. If one wanted
yes.
to map between
yeah.
CL and RIF, I guess it would be to the RIF FLD, right? Has that been considered?
Right. So, in RIF FLD, you can define a dialect which would be kind of very similar to CL. It's not clear whether the notion, I guess the notion of modules probably will be different, but without modules, it will be very similar to CL, this mapping can be defined to some dialect, which could be carved out of the RIF FLD.
Michael Gruninger also brought up onto IOP, so I'm wondering should the mappings be to onto IOP?
Should we define this dialect and put it in? I'm not sure what.
Yeah. So maybe Michael Gruninger, onto IOP, is that one of the kind of use cases for that standard? In other words, not directly mapping between common logic and a variant of RIF, but using onto IOP to do that mapping.
Right. So, I mean, I think it's one of the use cases within onto IOP. When they submitted to OMG, one of them was one of the use cases was doing a translation between RIF and some other ontology representation language. So the idea would be that's where you would be able to do the specification of the mapping between languages.
Hmm. Okay.
Not that anyone's done that yet, but I mean that was one of the use cases that
yeah.
Is in their request for a proposal.
I see. Okay.
Are there other questions, comments, and so on about RIF? If not, I think we are running out of time for today, and it was a great session. Thanks to all. I think people could continue a little bit in the chat room and ask more questions and discuss a little bit, and then maybe we will have a future continuation of the series. Thanks to all. Bye now.
Bye. Bye.